KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in this morning's opening hour of Forum, the Stanford Graduate School of Business is hosting an upcoming conference. It's all about business social responsibility and innovation. To what extent are business profits compatible with businesses that want to work for better social values and positive social change? Is corporate responsibility an oxymoron? We'll take up these and other questions with a panel, your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Net Impact 2005 is a conference that will be featuring some 1,200 participants from all over the world beginning November 13th and running through the 15th. Hosted by the Stanford Graduate School of Business, the conference is all about bridging the gap between business and social innovation. How can businesses act more socially responsible and still be true to their own self-interest and the proverbial bottom line of profit? In this morning's opening hour forum, we turn our attention to these and other related questions as we speak with participants in of the upcoming conference. Let me tell you who is in the studio with us. First of all, we want to welcome Chris Deigelmeyer, who is Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Welcome. Good morning.
Great. Thank you. Good morning.
Glad to have you with us. Also glad to have Kelly McElhaney, who is Executive Director and Adjunct Assistant Professor with UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business in the Center for Responsible Business there. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
And William Rosenzweig is here with us in studio. He's co-founder and managing director of Great Spirit Ventures and a board member of Net Impact. And welcome to you.
Thank you.
Good morning to you as well. Let me begin, Chris, with you. And let's begin by talking about this conference, which I know you're all excited about. What do you expect to accomplish with this conference?
I think one of the main focus of the conference is engaging students and young people from across the country to realize that business can have a larger impact than making profit. So it's providing 1,400 students and young people the opportunity to see real-life examples around social entrepreneurship, social investing, corporate social responsibility, with the long-term hope that they'll take that back with them, back to their schools, back to their work ethic, and continue through their lives of incorporating social values in what they do.
We've gone up from 1,200 to 1,400. I guess I needed that.
Well, you've got to include the, there's 250 panelists also attending. So you get from the, add those extra 250, and we've got a lot of people on campus. And just to put it in perspective, it's the largest conference Stanford has ever held.
It's also raises all kinds of questions, I mean, about how you, either in the universities or in a conference like this, how you, maybe foment wouldn't be too strong a word, that sense of social value and that sense of social responsibility that obviously you're all about here. In many respects, it's often window dressing. You know, we hear about greenwashing, we hear about PR for companies, or we hear companies that are motivated because they have a negative image, like Nike has been, and Walgreens, and or Walmart, excuse me, and so forth. I mean, how really to integrate the two? That's really what you're talking about, isn't it? Instilling that sense of those two going hand in hand, profit, bottom line, and social responsibility.
Correct. And I think with any change in society, it's a progression. And so for companies, they're learning as they go. And so I think if you look right now of, you know, corporate social responsibility that's been around, infusing it within their operations, oh, we're not going to include child labor, we're not going to discard toxic waste. I think there's a lot of innovative things companies are doing today in terms of creating products for a social benefit, and that includes small startup social entrepreneur organizations. We launched out of one of our courses last year, a for-profit company that looks at providing low-cost lighting to the billion of people in the world without electricity that rely on kerosene right now.
That was a great idea, but then it was decided rather than have it nonprofit, it would go profit, wasn't it?
But I think this one of the reasons the center exists, we focus around dissolving boundaries. That I think if we're really going to solve social problems these days, we've got to look across the business, government, and nonprofit sectors. And so how an organization decides what its tax code could be, I think, is less important than they're having a social impact. And when they looked at how can we reach the most number of people and you looked at working capital, the decision was made, let's do this as a for-profit company.
You know, I have to tell you, I had a conversation with a friend recently who was doing some research on the whole notion of shareholder value and where that came into become institutionalized. It's often used as a disguise for perhaps lack of social responsibility. That is, we have our obligation to our shareholders, and again, it becomes the profit as the bottom line, which eclipses the sense of what we might be doing for the common good.
It's a continued struggle, and you talk to executives, and the reality is the analysts look at their quarterly profits, when you're looking at social impact, it's a much longer time horizon.
And much more difficult to quantify.
Much more difficult to quantify, but I sit the Corporation for Encouraging Corporate Philanthropy. So it was top CEOs of Lucent, McGraw-Hill, GlaxoSmithKline. Every single one of those CEOs said their role has fundamentally changed in terms of ensuring their company is socially responsible. So I think it's more than window dressing. I think the demand is from customers.
Making progress.
I think we are making progress. Right. It doesn't mean there's not a long way to go, and that's why we need business schools at Haas, at Berkeley, across the country focusing on this. But I do think we're making progress.
Chris Teigelmeyer, again, is Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And Callie McElhaney is Executive Director and Adjunct Assistant Professor at UC Berkeley Haas School of Business and is with the Center for Responsible Business there. There seems to be a whole notion here of corporate social responsibility. I mean, that's kind of your bailiwick. What do we mean when we talk about corporate social responsibility? Because, you know, some people see that as oxymoronic.
Yeah. So did my cab driver this morning. He had a good laugh at why I was going to be on your show. So if he's listening, here we go. Part of the challenge, it's an emergent field. And so I can't tell you, Will and I could probably argue for an hour over how you define corporate responsibility, because I don't think we in the field yet agree. But I have a very succinct and boundaried definition, at least for the center, the teaching that I do and the research that I do. And we look at corporate social responsibility as a corporate strategy. And it has to be linked to two things in the business world: core business objectives. So if you're going to talk about a company like Gap to sell more apparel, and it has to be linked, secondly, to core competency. So for Gap, it needs to be linked to what they know and do well as a company. And it exists to create both positive financial and social/environmental return. So it's got to be linked to financial return, because whether we like it or not, companies have to produce a financial profit or they cease to exist. So it doesn't matter how socially responsible they were or were not if they no longer exist.
Had an academic on with us recently who referred to corporations as sociopathic, and it got a big response from that. As somebody said, that's very intemperate language. Somebody else said, we had two sort of polarized responses. A lot of people saying that was intemperate language. A lot of people saying that's right on the money. Mm-hmm. Somebody from Stanford, paradoxically enough.
Not from Berkeley. That's amazing.
No. But you know, his point of view is everything should be and has to be bottom line with a corporation. Mm-hmm. A corporation may have a lot of rhetoric about mm-hmm. social responsibility, but that's not going to be where their real hearts are going to be. In fact, just an example, I had a conversation with somebody in the commercial media yesterday, and I was saying the difference between us and you is that you can win all these great awards for social work in terms of furthering values, win Peabody, for example, or win mm-hmm. something that has to do with bringing about social change. But the bottom line is, how many people are listening to you? And that's not true over here. I mean, I don't mean that in a self-serving way.
Right.
When we win Peabody's, we're ecstatic, and we don't necessarily, like a lot of listeners, because it means a lot of pledges, but it doesn't.
It's driven by different drivers.
They're different drivers, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
And companies, you know, I think the thing that is wonderful about the sort of bubbling up of this corporate responsibility is companies have learned either the hard way through pain, which is fine, because if they learn, frankly, in my classes, I'm not so caught up in the motivation of why they do it. I'm much more interested in the outcomes on society, on the environment. But companies have really learned that it's not just about shareholder maximization. That is still key and critical, and we can't forget about that, but it's about a broader set of stakeholders, being employees, being consumers, that being the community, that being new markets in which they enter in India or China. So it's a bit of a broadening of a model as opposed to an obliteration of the model of capitalism. It's just a broadening of the model of capitalism from a shareholder-driven model to a stakeholder-driven model.
You talk about trends in this way with multinationals. Again, you're pretty positive and sanguine about that.
I am. Will is going to speak to the whole social entrepreneurship sector. Most of my work is with large multinational corporations, but I am very positive, and I don't mean to be Pollyanna-ish about it, because I do have data and evidence to suggest that this is not just a passing fad. Some companies have viewed it as such, but I don't think they'll be around for the long haul. The companies who have really mainstreamed this and integrated it in with their core business operations, it's not going to be a passing fad for those companies.
Well, you also talk about retrofitting, I think is a word you use, long-established companies. And right. How does one go about doing that?
It's a very difficult row to hoe. I mean, Will can speak much more to starting a socially minded mission from the get-go, which is always easier. But we do have some good examples of retrofitting, if you will, mainstream corporations. And the way I show it is the more pain a company has felt, the easier it is to retrofit that company. But I think one of the biggest drivers in retrofitting has been employees, because employees are saying, look, I want to come to work every day and I want to feel actually good about where I'm spending 50, 60 hours a week. Doesn't mean I don't want to increase sales for the company, but I also want to feel good about what I'm doing with my life. And that's been a real turning point for companies.
Well, you got a bottle of Starbucks water right in front of
exactly,
you.
Exactly, ethos, right?
Kelly McElhenney is Executive Director and Adjunct Assistant Professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. She's in the Center for Responsible Business there. And Will Rosenzweig, you do prefer Will, as co-founder and managing director of Great Spirits Venture and board member of Net Impact, also teaches social entrepreneurship over at UC Berkeley. Is this easy to put into a business plan? It seems like it would be pretty difficult or challenging.
It's challenging. It's not that different than a traditional business plan, but it has some different components. In a social venture, the entrepreneur is looking to elevate perhaps the social value creation to a level perhaps equivalent to the financial impact, as opposed to a secondary position. It's an idealistic and hopeful attempt right now, but these entrepreneurs are looking to innovate and actually maximize, design their businesses in a way that they can measure and track and make management decisions that enhance both bottom lines, a financial and a social.
This is the idea of the double bottom line.
Correct.
Again. Yeah, but it's so hard to quantify, you know, social value, and isn't it?
It is. It's been somewhat experimental and hypothetical, but in the last 3 years, it's been very interesting to watch a number of substantial organizations, foundations in particular, begin to really experiment in this area and put resources behind rigorous efforts to begin to measure this kind of intangible. The Rockefeller Foundation has been very progressive in this sense and has sponsored a whole program to try to measure the bottom line, second bottom line, and has used these tools to help new entrepreneurs and ongoing entrepreneurs really get some rigor around this.
And this conference, I mean, the hope that's attached to this conference in part is that it will lead to more, even more leadership in this area.
Well, I think that's what's so exciting to watch Net Impact grow, is that when you take a group of very capable and dedicated, ambitious students who have high expectations for themselves and I think the world around them, and then you see that converge with some idealism and a lot of pragmatism too, you get a very potent and exciting sense of the leadership potential that, you know, could be coming in the generations ahead.
This is really, let's call it what it is. It's an attempt at a grassroots movement, isn't it?
It really is a grassroots movement. And Net Impact, when you look at how it's grown over the last 10 years from really a very, very small group of people that gathered at Georgetown University, I remember the night very vividly. Now there's over 13,000 members around the world. There's over 100 chapters involved. There's now an alumni association, so as the students pass from their undergraduate and graduate educations, they're staying in touch and involved, and then these graduates go on to places of leadership in corporations, and it's creating really a system, if you will, of shared values and shared vision.
Will Rosenzweig, again, is co-founder and managing director of Great Spirit Ventures and a board member of Net Impact and teaches social entrepreneurship at UC Berkeley. I'm going to bring in Lloyd Kurtz into this conversation. He's a senior portfolio manager with Nelson Capital Management. They're a division of Wells Fargo, and he joins us by phone from his office in Palo Alto. And welcome, Lloyd Kurtz. Glad to have you aboard.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Sometimes it seems pretty difficult getting people on board with this because if they look at it and they say, gee, it's going to be profit or it's going to be social innovation and social value and a choice between the two, they can be pretty skeptical, can't they?
Certainly can. I think for some people it resonates intuitively. A lot of people say, well, it just makes sense that if you do a good job with employees and customers, company's probably going to be a terrific franchise and worth investing in. But a lot of other people say, you know, if you give money to charity, if you're paying people more than you need to pay them, that's going to hurt your bottom line. It's interesting because when you look at the studies, most of the academic studies and the reviews that have been done do show that the bottom line is not hurt, may even be helped by some of these initiatives.
I thought the jury was still out on whether or not there are higher returns.
I think that the returns are measured at two levels. One is corporate profits, and I think there's pretty good evidence that social responsibility is associated with higher corporate profits. Now, you can argue about what's causing that. Are companies spending more because they're rich, or are they being socially responsible and that's helping their business? At the stock market level, the jury's very much out because the stock market is very good at recognizing that companies' earnings power and can price the securities to reflect that higher level of earnings. So for social responsibility to pay in the stock market, you need not only to have a positive benefit on earnings, but then you need to have that not be fully recognized by the market so investors can take advantage of it.
Yeah, I'd like to see a stock index one day that has a measurement of this. You think that may be coming down the line sometime?
Well, certainly there's one index, the Domini Social Index. I worked on it long ago. It's been around for 15 years, and it's an index of 400 stocks that are more socially responsible than average, and they're pretty careful about how they put it together. It's actually been better than the market over the past 15 years, although rigorous financial analysis would suggest that that's not because of the social screens, but because of some other factors.
Yeah, well, how much do investors look at that?
How much do they look at the performance of the index?
Yeah.
I think it's drawn a lot of attention. Investors are attentive to evidence over ideology, and I think that once the Domini Index and some of the other social investment products pass the 10-year mark with competitive returns, the critics really damped down the intensity of their attacks because there was a recognition of, you know, I don't think this should work, but it seems to be working.
The key word one keeps hearing in all this is sustainability. That is sustainability having to do not only with products and the environment, but the way employees are treated and all of that. I mean, do you see signs that really are particularly hopeful, like my guests here in studio?
I see signs that are hopeful. I think that there are a couple of factors in play. Certainly we've seen Walmart this year. We've seen General Electric both begin to commit to sustainability in a press release and CEO speech kind of way. Whether that's going to translate into meaningful action over time, you know, we're just going to have to see. But you do have very large companies like British Petroleum, I think, has really drawn a line in the sand and said, we are going to really make a serious organizational-wide effort to bring more sustainable practices to the organization. I think 10 years ago that would have been unheard of.
Again, Lloyd Kurtz with us by phone, a senior portfolio manager with Nelson Capital Management, their division of Wells Fargo. And Chris Deigelmeyer, can you give us some examples that come quickly to mind here of real victory in this sense of what you see as social value?
Yeah. Back to kind of my earlier comment, I think what I see, I don't know if category of victory, but what I see is coming more so around innovation is companies moving beyond just their operations in terms of corporate social responsibility to leverage their assets for a social benefit. We just did an award this last year with Amazon, so it was the Nonprofit Social Innovation Award. So Amazon said, boy, we're a big company. What's our platform? We have access to millions and millions of people. How can we use that platform for a social benefit? So instead of doing a traditional, you know, corporate foundation program, they said, oh, we're going to use this innovation award. We're going to use our platform to have a social impact. I think you look at Cisco Systems that was just awarded the U.S. State Department Award for the work that they're doing with the country of Jordan on the Jordan Education Initiative. So Cisco is building off, you know, its core competency of networks to work with the government of Jordan, NGOs throughout the country to provide network training for the people of that country. And they have plans in place because it has been so successful to expand that in Egypt and Palestine. So I think those are exciting new initiatives that are really very innovative that also are having a broader social impact beyond the traditional sense of I'm going to be, you know, a socially responsible company in my operations.
Kelly McElhaney, we were talking about multinationals, or at least we touched on it. Is it more difficult now as we become more and more globalized to have this kind of commitment to social responsibility? For example, HP has always been, you know, the paragon company, but one would think that the challenges are even greater than they've ever been.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's part of the core things I want to express about corporate social responsibility. It's highly complex, and I think we try to oversimplify things, that it's an either-or decision. I'm either going to be financially profitable or socially responsible, and it's not necessarily either-or, but particularly as we look at the global markets, I mean, even the definition of what is responsible in America versus what is responsible in China or in Pakistan is quite challenging.
Bill, Will Rosenzweig, can you help us on that? I mean, it is quite challenging, and how do companies really grapple with this? I know that you're as a venture capitalist, everything your focus has been much more local, but obviously we're moving more and more global.
Well, I think we're moving into models of exploring this integration that Kelly's talking about between this. The strategy becomes holistic in a sense that it's generating both financial and social value, as opposed to this either-or approach. And I think it's interesting.
Wouldn't most companies give the nod, though, to the profit rather than social value if it really came down to the crunch?
Well, I think the social value is also somewhat in the eyes of the beholder, and there's a timing issue to it, too. If you look back, say, 15 years to the organic food movement, you'd see a lot of sort of young, entrepreneurially driven companies that thought of themselves as sort of alternative or renegade companies like Odwalla or Stonyfield Farms that were trying to go out and do something that they thought was better, you know, and they were trying to innovate. And they were kind of flying in the face of big corporate, you know, interests that controlled a lot of the distribution system. Well, if you look now over the last 5 years, these big multinational companies have bought the majority of these entrepreneurial innovators and tried to integrate their you know, both their customers and their values into the bigger company. And I think one of the topics at the Net Impact Conference that's going to be interesting is to talk about how does a values-driven company survive, or what survives in the event of this acquisition.
Well, but often I'm thinking about somebody like Ben and Jerry. You know, they sell their company, the company is taken over by the behemoth corporation, and suddenly have employees being driven out because there's, you know, looking at quarterly shares, looking at shareholder profits.
Well, I think Ben and Jerry's is a great case study, because you could look and say, where were their social values? Were they in practices, or were they in the product? Which social values are going to endure as the company scales? I think that's the question. If you look at Stonyfield Farms, for instance, a lot of their values about, you know, not having bovine growth hormone in their product or being strictly organic, these have all survived the acquisition with Danone. So I think it becomes more of a design issue for business leaders.
You also get into that whole problem of they're making ice cream, which is not necessarily healthy
begin
with.
Yes.
And can I speak to the Ben and Jerry's model? Because, yes, you know, I may be a little unpopular in the way that I teach that case in my classes, but just because somebody is socially responsible doesn't necessarily mean it is good. It's executed well. It's strategic. So Ben and Jerry's is an ice cream maker. The fact that during the first Iraq situation, I could read about Ben Cohen's views on why the U.S. should or should not be involved in foreign affairs, that's not necessarily his core competency. That's not necessarily why I, as a consumer of ice cream, bought this ice cream.
Well, you also got the scion to the Baskin-Robbins family. Well, anyway, I'm going to get into ice cream here, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give out the phone number and invite those of you listening to join us. In fact, you're welcome to do that right now, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, that toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you're welcome to join us, and we invite your calls. Or email us, forum@kqed.org. We're talking about how companies and business schools are developing corporate strategies to achieve social and financial goals. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about really how you dissolve the boundaries that exist between profit and nonprofit, and make those who are out for profit much more concerned about what usually is the concern of the nonprofit sector. I like to say that the difference sometimes between commercial and public radio is the fact that here I've been 5 years on Sirius Satellite, have seen no remuneration, don't expect I will. Howard Stern just signed a contract with them 5 years for $100 million. There's the essential difference right there. Talking about this with Chris Deigelmeyer, who is Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation at Stanford Graduate School of Business, Kelly McElhaney, Executive Director and Adjunct Assistant Professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business with the Center for Responsible Business there, and Will Rosenzweig, who is co-founder and managing director of Great Spirit Ventures and a board member of Net Impact, and they're sponsoring this conference, which we should say another word about because there are going to be people who will want to know. It's open to the public, and people can still enroll, or it's not open to the public? It's closed? What?
It's sold out in early registration. So, again, I think it's a testament to the demand that's out there. So, unfortunately, it is not open any longer. But there will be one again next year somewhere in the country.
And since, as we were just saying off air, I did an event for you at Stanford a while back for the Center for Social Innovation, which is in your journal, the whole transcript of it. This will all be on your website and on the in the Journal on Social Innovation?
Yes. Yes.
So people can access what
Yeah, what we're doing is not the entire conference, but key sessions we'll be doing webcast on, so you can go online to the Center for Social Innovation and see some of the sessions that go on at the conference.
Great. And we'll give people information on that before you leave here.
Yes.
Also want to mention, I don't want to forget the fact that Lloyd Kurtz is with us. Lloyd is Senior Portfolio Manager with Nelson Capital Management, Division of Wells Fargo. Can you stay for a while, Lloyd?
Sure.
Great to have you, and we'll bring our callers in and our emailers, and let's go right to your calls. Christine is first up. Hi, Christine.
Hi, Michael. You're such a joy to listen to every morning when I'm on my way to work.
So nice of you to say. Thank you.
I'm a shop manager for The Body Shop, and the founder of my company, Anita Roddick, has always maintained that you can have profits with principles, and we operate in over 50 countries. And, you know, the biggest piece of what we do is the community trade issue of making sure that we treat as fairly as we can. We always pay a fair market price for the raw ingredients that go into our product. And it's really about the fact that I could make more money and I could go to pretty much any other company in retail and make a much bigger wage, but it really is important to me that I feel good at the end of the day about what I do.
Yeah, that's what Anita's all about. We had her on when she put out her book about the story of The Body Shop, and there are people like Anita Roddick who are really tireless almost in this kind of commitment, and ought to be singled out and given some kudos here, no?
She's a pioneer as well. Yes. She took a lot of arrows for doing things the way she did it because she was one of the earlier sort of leaders in this movement, and you know, it takes a lot of chutzpah to continue down a path that the rest of the world is telling you is either meaningless, not smart, or not profitable.
Well, and I think the point of the caller, though, that
Chris Dagelmeier
is also important, is her point of she's willing to take mm-hmm. less pay to be involved in a company that has social values. And we find from our MBA students that it is high on their list that if I'm going to go work for a company, I want it to have a certain level of social value. They're not necessarily saying I'm going to go work in the corporate social responsibility arena. Some are saying that, but they have a higher standard. So I think for companies to be competitive right now for the top, the brightest, and the best students, it's one of the elements they are looking for.
Christine, I'm glad you feel good about where you work, and I'm glad you find joy in listening to this program. And Will Rosenzweig, you want to say something?
Well, it also brings up this issue that I think a lot of students and others bristle at, that's what's the discount involved with being socially responsible? You know, if I'm going to make an investment, should I expect a lower return? Or if I'm going to accept a job, should I accept expect a lower wage? I think this is an issue that people are really grappling with. Maybe the shareholders aren't taking a discount, but are other people along the way taking a discount? And I think as we get further along at actually being able to measure and quantify what's going on, we'll have better answers to this.
Yeah, like Kurt said, I want to ask you this. That's been an issue at Wells Fargo.
Well, if I can just wrap up on The Body Shop first, just to Will's point, Body Shop, despite the fact that they have such a tremendous social responsibility record, has also gotten significant economic benefits from Anita's involvement. If you look at...
You mean as good PR?
Yeah, and that's one of the difficult to measure but very tangible benefits of social responsibility is it's good for business, it's good advertising. And so the people who study the financial impacts have done a lot of work trying to figure out, well, why would companies act in seemingly an altruistic way? One reason is it builds your reputation in the community.
And the consumers feel good when they know they're buying a product from someone who's socially responsible, right?
Yeah.
From a company that's socially responsible. But, again, it's very hard to quantify just how much that helps the bottom line.
That's right. And in business, you have a lot of things like that. It ends up being a judgment call. You were going to ask about Wells Fargo, which is the largest corporate giver in the Bay Area. You know, that's partly because there's been a business judgment that it's the right thing to do. And it probably eases relationships with the firm's many stakeholders.
Let's not disregard the fact that happy employees, satisfied employees, proofs for financial return as well.
That's right.
Again, difficult to quantify, but obviously true. Lloyd, I was going to ask you something else. Milt Moskowitz, a name I know you're familiar with, and someone who I've worked with on air through the years when he started doing these books, when he was writing for the old San Francisco Examiner and doing these studies of what companies were doing well for people and providing social benefits. Again, when you're looking at this as an investor, how much weight does it really have?
It's interesting. You know, the serious studies hadn't been done until fairly recently. Now we're starting to see them. You know, Milt, 10 years ago, this was primarily an ideological debate. You'd have, say, a Milton Friedman on one side and Ben Cohen on the other, but from an investor standpoint, it was a pretty fact-free environment. And one thing we did was, in collaboration with a number of other folks in the investment community, we just started to put up a cash prize for the best quantitative study of social investing, and we named it after Milt. It's called the Moskowitz Prize. We gave our 10th one this year. Nadia Gunster at Erasmus University in the Netherlands won it. And she showed that environmental records of corporations are being built into the valuation fabric in the stock market, showing that investors are attentive to the environmental behavior of companies. So Milt's had a profound influence on what we've done, and we've honored him with that prize. One other aspect of his work that I think is noteworthy, every year you have the 100 best companies to work for in America, appears in Fortune magazine. I did some work with some quantitative friends on that list. And, you know, over the years, that's been a pretty good investment. That's been a pretty good list. Even after you adjust for a lot of the standard investment factors, there you can make the argument that good employee relations has been good for shareholder returns over time.
I want to go to more of your calls. Just a quick email here from Bruce, who's writing us from Philadelphia. It says, companies that invest in social responsibility or being a good neighbor can do a lot to eliminate potential problems in their communities or the environment in which they operate. There was a study at the Kennedy School at Harvard that showed that money invested in being a good corporate citizen alleviated many problems that the companies may have faced in terms of antagonistic outward responses to their businesses. And we'll go to more of your calls. And Chris, you're next up. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. Thank you. I think this is an extremely interesting topic. I've been a Silicon Valley executive for about 15 years, and I've always gravitated towards companies where the product had a transformational positive outcome. Like you mentioned webcasting a few minutes ago. I was actually interested in webcasting, and I was there because it was so fascinating that we could save the environment, something that actually made people more profitable. And I don't think social value has to be a Trojan horse in that sense, so I was wondering what your commentators would think.
You want to jump in here, Kelly?
Trojan horse is a great way to, hopefully they're wooden because they take, again, a lot of arrows. But, I think the proof, what Lloyd is talking about, is it's no longer a fact-free environment. But for a long time, it was a fact-free environment. So you really had leaders of companies who were very pioneering and not, there was no cookbook, there was no recipe out there. Even today, one of the struggles I have is that it's hard to get companies to talk about their failures in this realm. And I think we learn better from past failures. So you see a lot of success stories out there. But for every success story, I mean, Will would probably have a better statistic on this, but there have to be 100 failures out there.
You know, just to be a little ideological for a moment, as a weakness of mine from time to time. I see there's a kind of a Manichaean battle going on here, you know, a binary battle. I mean, you folks are all about social value and social responsibility and so forth, and, you know, you have these greedy monsters out there. I mean, the Enrons, the Tycos, and so forth, and they're really kind of pulling both ways, aren't they?
Well, I think the system is part of the challenge. I think by nature, again, I'll be ideological or idealistic as well. I think human beings by nature are not inherently evil. But the system, particularly Wall Street...
Now you're being theological.
Okay. Well, I've never been accused of that before at Berkeley.
Or metaphysical.
Metaphysical. You know, but I just think that the system... We once brought in a white-collar criminal, if you will, from MCI, formerly from MCI, now from prison. And he spoke to our MBA students, and it was quite poignant to hear how he went from making a very tiny decision because his boss asked him to do something on the books to landing in jail. And what the students walked away with was a bit of a... holy cow, that could so, I can see how that could happen as opposed to, he's in jail, he's a criminal, I'm an MBA student at Berkeley, we are two totally different people.
Well, I know people in business who will say, you know, you got to be a little bit crooked, even if it's just with the government, with taxes and so forth. The only way that you can really do well and really survive, because they're just so predatory out there and you're always struggling to make a buck, and that's the reality of it. And so, you know, if you're going to be clean and honest and pure and so forth, forget it. I mean, that's what you hear repeatedly.
You might ask Skilling how he feels about that viewpoint right now.
Skilling as he sits in jail. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, good example. But let's go to more calls. Randy, you're on. Hi.
Hi, I had a question about how do you value value? I mean, what's the difference between how do you quantitatively value somebody who, a company who spends $50,000 to promote a $10,000 grant they gave to a farmer, or, you know, a company that's touting something they're doing, which is really, you know, just responding to a shakedown by Jesse Jackson or somebody like that. I mean, how do you quantify some of this stuff?
How do you do that, Lloyd Kurtz?
Well, in the end, you know, from an investment perspective, it has to work as an investment. So you've got people who are smart about it and people who are dumb about it. Let me give an example of a smart one. Paul Dolan, when he was CEO up at Fetzer Vineyards, which was a Brown-Forman subsidiary, discovered kind of by accident that organic grapes made better wine than non-organic grapes. And he looked out at acres and acres of fields of non-organic grapes, and he figured out that for a pretty small incremental investment, he could take a big step forward in the quality of his product. And he was operating in a very competitive global industry and took market share because he had a better product at the price point. So I think that's an example of being socially responsible in a economically positive way. The much tougher situation is, you know, yeah, there are stories where companies pour a lot of money into a social, well-intended social initiative. There's no return for shareholders. It's harmful to the business. It's a distraction. And there have been companies that have foundered on those types of initiatives. So it does come down to an element of business judgment. And I think that social investors often view a company's performance on social metrics as an indicator of management competence. If a company has a social crisis or some type of social challenge, maybe they handle it well, the way J&J didn't in the Tylenol case, where they acted very quickly and very responsibly. Or maybe they handle it badly, try and cover it up, stonewall, and end up costing shareholders a lot of money.
Before I go to more calls here, I want to go to a few more of your emails. This is Mark, who writes, corporations have a duty to act in the interest of their shareholders, but shareholders have interest beyond profits. Millions of Americans own corporations, often through mutual funds. If a corporation does something damaging to society, such as harming the environment, fixing prices, or perverting legislation, that corporation is likely harming its own shareholders. Board members and executives should look beyond Wall Street investors and work in the true interest of their shareholders. You know what's interesting about this? I guess some of you may know there's a new book out by a guy at Hoover all about all of the people on the left and the icons of the left and what kinds of holdings they have and what they've invested in. And it's, you know, maybe shocking to some people, but when you think about mutual funds, it's not necessarily that shocking to see that somebody on the left, like, say, Michael Moore, is an investor in Halliburton or, you know, that sort of thing. It's so difficult. And, Lloyd, I want to get your take on this. It's just so difficult to be pure about this. I mean, unless you're investing in the Grameen Bank or something, you know.
I guess after the fact, people are digging up dirt on Mother Teresa.
Christopher Hitchens wrote a whole book about that.
We live in a world of a million shades of gray, and I have a lot of very idealistic clients, and one of our challenges is working with an idealistic client, and in the end, we have to draw a line somewhere and say this company, for its flaws, is still good enough to be in the portfolio, and this company's flaws are so numerous that they really shouldn't be.
All right, here you go, Will Rosenzweig. Here's an email from a listener from the Stanford Business School who says, do the representatives believe, that means you and the others here, believe that companies would do something that was socially responsible if it were not good for the bottom line? If not, then do you really believe the companies are being socially responsible if they do something because it serves the bottom line?
Well, I think that gets right to the point. It's an integrated strategy. I think you can't disregard businesses are measured by their bottom line, that we use financial measures as the primary measure of success. This is what attracts more capital. This is what sustains the ongoing nature of a business. So we can't depart from that in the business world. But what we can do is begin to integrate and understand the implications of our actions as business leaders to a full range of outcomes, not just financial.
We'll go to more of your calls, and we welcome next Ethan, who's joining us from Oakland this morning. Hi, Ethan.
Hi. I'm calling. I actually telecommute for a company that is back in Philadelphia called Solutions for Progress, and I just feel like something that's been missed in all of this discussion, at least from what I've heard, has been a discussion of companies that are for profit but are out to do the good. It has been more on, like, corporate giving and that aspect of corporations. And my company is a technically for-profit company, but we're making a product called the Benefit Bank, which is an online application which would allow low- and moderate-income people to apply for public benefits, they differ state by state, and apply and file their state and federal taxes And it just seems like companies that are for profit and doing sort of good work exist out there as well and are just sort of being missed in this discussion. So I sort of wanted to bring that up.
All right, I'm glad you did. Who wants to jump in?
I can jump in.
I'm glad you brought it up because I think this is an area around corporate social responsibility that is probably experiencing a big growth right now. And back to Michael's point before when I talked about Ignite, that's producing lighting for low-income people across the world. They made a decision to be a for-profit company because they bet that they could be more likely get to scale. And so I think this is happening more often, in particular in startup organizations, that they're developing products that are also meeting a social need.
But let's talk about some of the mainstream corporate...
Kelly McElhinney.
Some of the mainstream corporations. I mean, Nike has just launched an entire sustainably produced footwear line called Consider. Gap has just released in their social responsibility report all of the names and addresses and violations of their suppliers, the factories all over the world. Levi followed suit. McDonald's is putting milk into Happy Meals. I mean, you have lots and lots of examples of companies who are for-profit and relatively powerful in our world who are moving in this trajectory.
Actually, on that note, here's Teresa who writes, I'm the co-founder of a nonprofit called Fishwise that works with grocery stores to label fresh seafood with sustainability information. All our member stores have seen an increase in total seafood sales and a shift away from unsustainable products after our program is implemented. We require stores to label not only the sustainable products as sustainable, but also the unsustainable products as unsustainable. And we found that the transparency is what the customers really are demanding. Thus, I was wondering if companies see positive benefits just by being honest about their practices, or if only claims of social responsibility make customers and shareholders happy.
Well, this is a great example of filling an unmet need. Mm-hmm. Consumers want to know what's going on with their food. So this is a very good example of innovation. And I think we're seeing early stage entrepreneurs continue to innovate, and particularly with new models where
but they're all tied together.
They are.
The innovation
That's right. And you know, we're looking at new business models that integrate both a for-profit component and a nonprofit component. The last winning firm of the Global Social Venture Competition brought forth an integrated model that had sort of sister companies, if you will, pursuing a mutual mission.
We'll go to more calls, and next up, William. Good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. I'd like to draw attention to something that you said, Michael, and that one of the women guests said, and I'm sorry, I don't know which one it was, but one of them pointed out that a company, GlaxoSmithKline, had informed her that they were really paying a great deal of attention to social responsibility, and not directly in response to that, but you made the point, Michael, that one must be suspicious of what's called what you described as greenwashing. In other words, something that looks good, but really it's only a small part of what they're doing, or it's not true. And something came to my mind recently with respect to that, and that is that in the advertisements for the ballot initiatives, there was a Proposition 79, which would have required drug companies to negotiate with the state for lower prices for the poorer people in our state. And right at the bottom of the advertisements that came over and over again on television against that proposition, it mentioned that GlaxoSmithKline was one of the major donors against the initiative, which would have required the drug companies to negotiate lower prices. And I wondered how the guests would reconcile that with the statement that GlaxoSmithKline is very socially responsible.
Chris, I think that's to you.
Yeah, that was to me. So I think with all these companies, it's the complexity issue, and that there is no stringent one way of what is considered socially responsible, and they are continuing to look out for their business bottom line. And I'm not familiar enough with the ballot initiative to make a comment on that. So what I can comment on is if you do look at the work that they've done through their community programs in terms of addressing HIV and AIDS and diseases in sub-Saharan Africa, where they're putting their resources forth to work with, again, NGOs and governments to address those diseases, I think is a good step forward and a unique way of leveraging their business asset for a social value. And so I'm sure they have other, you know, rationales for why they chose to oppose that initiative. And I think it's a testament to the complexity of this issue.
Take that point of complexity, and William, thank you for the call. Lloyd, Chris, when you look at companies, it's often this way, isn't it, that you sort of look at positives and negatives and try to size it up accordingly?
Yeah, definitely. And I think especially the pharmaceutical industry, it's funny. If the pharmaceutical industry, so many of the decisions are around life and death kind of issues. You're really talking about people's health. And so, you know, you can have a $200 million movie, and people don't really mind that. But when you have a $200 million drug, people are like, well, why can't we get that more inexpensively? And so you have this dimension where it really is impacting people's lives. And it makes it difficult for the managements because they are answerable to society at large, probably more than other companies, and they have shareholders. So
you're also often looking at what the drug companies don't do that they could do, but they won't do because why take it on when it's not going to reap a lot of profit?
Well, the perfect example of that is malaria, where
there you go.
You know, you could put, you know, that's one of the number one killers in the world today, but there's really not an economic opportunity. The drug companies can't figure out how to get paid for developing the drug. There have been instances, you know, for example, Merck with its river blindness drug in Africa, where they have a drug and they've really been proactive about getting it out to populations that need it.
And that had a lot to do with former President Carter getting behind it.
Yep.
A great deal to do with that, in fact. But let me go to more of our calls here. And Beth, you're on.
Hi. My question has to do with consumer responsibility in the sense that if consumers want their jeans to be $9.99 at Walmart, they can't really complain about labor standards in China. But if I'm willing to spend $3 for a cup of coffee at Starbucks, I can have a workforce where part-time workers have health insurance. And so it seems to me that a lot of it comes down to getting the consumer to be willing, you know, to accept responsibility.
Your comments are getting Kelly McElhaney chomping at the bit to answer.
Well, that's one of my former students. I recognize that voice. And it's an unpopular thing that I continuously harp on. And I've been attacked by NGO individuals who say, how can I even say this? But, you know, there's been such a pendulum movement towards corporate responsibility that there's no longer any focus on individual responsibility. So a woman can spill coffee on her lap in her car while driving and probably putting on lipstick and speaking on the cell phone and sue McDonald's for producing coffee that's too hot. I mean, why, for God's unknown reason, there are Hummers in downtown San Francisco continues to baffle me. There's just no need other than consumers have this undescribable desire to have a war vehicle in an urban city.
Many of them the same consumers who will say it's irresponsible for companies to make so many
Absolutely.
SUVs or for car manufacturers to make so many SUVs.
Yeah. I mean, I read in San Francisco Magazine, for example, that 40% of hybrid drivers in the Bay Area, their second car that's back in their garage is an SUV. So let's talk about the contradictions with individuals in our society, and especially in America today.
Ah, hypocrisy, just like Ralph Waldo Emerson said, the essence of life sometimes. Let's go to more of your calls. Jenny, hi.
Hi. First of all, most of the shoppers at Walmart can't afford to shop anywhere else but Walmart. But I wanted to talk about how, you know, one bottom line that people need to pay attention to when they're looking at these corporations behaving so responsibly is, are they allowing their employees to be unionized? Are they providing decent pensions? And is their product going to kill when used as intended? And I'm thinking particularly of Altria, which is actually Philip Morris Tobacco Company, funded at the Berkeley Rep, is funding the new Maurice Sendak Tony Kushner play. And it's just ironic that Philip Morris cigarettes are trying to buy legitimacy by funding a children's play in Berkeley. Really, I think the corporations are so riddled with problems that for me the solution is the government. We are feeling like we are part of a great community, and government fund the arts, government fund environmental programs. We all contribute through taxes, and we get it distributed fairly, and government regulate corporations. I don't think we can trust corporations to always do the right thing.
Thank you for that editorial comment. I appreciate your call. That's Jenny. And
the caller,
Lloyd Kurtz,
certainly has hit on a point that's been made, I think, in the larger conversation about corporate responsibility and finance. And that is, you know, over the past 20, 30 years, societies around the world have made a steady series of decisions which have had the effect of pulling back the impact of government. And that's, you know, voters and consumers around the world have said, you know, we want less government, we want more business, we want more involvement of free markets. And that's been a pretty steady trend. And Steven Leidenberg of Domini Investments has written a book arguing that, you know, that what goes with that is a greater obligation on the part of businesses. If we're going to move responsibilities away from government, someone else is going to have to pick them up. And businesses need to recognize you can't really have it both ways. You can't have government completely withdraw from aspects of your operation and then expect to have the same autonomy of action or lack of accountability that you would if there was a government looking over your shoulder.
Well, this has been an interesting and, I must say, enlightening conversation. And again, if we can give out information about where people can find out all they can find out or want to find out about the conference and read about it and so forth.
You can go to Stanford's website, gsb.stanford.edu, and type in Net Impact, and it'll take you directly to the Net Impact website for this conference. And again, following up on the conference, if you're unable to attend, there'll be some webcast and some podcast of some of the sessions.
And there's your journal as well.
Yes.
Yes, and of course, this hour can be podcast. Thank you all. Appreciate your being with us. Again, let me thank Lloyd Kurtz, Senior Portfolio Manager with Nelson Capital Management, Division of Wells Fargo, Will Rosenzweig, Co-Founder and Managing Director of Great Spirit Ventures and a board member of Net Impact, and Chris Deigelmeyer, Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation with the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and Kelly McElhaney, who is Executive Director and Adjunct Assistant Professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Thanks to you, our listeners. Glad to have you with us and hope you will stay with us. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Kevin Guillory, and Ariana Picari. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.